Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined, as I am in every episode, by my co-host, Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Great. Nice to be here in Canary Wharf again.
Beautiful, rainy Canary Wharf. And we're delighted to be joined on the podcast today by my colleague, Spike columnist and Long Reads editor, Tim Black. How are you doing, Tim?
Not too bad. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us today, even though this is in the office in which you work. We appreciate the effort. Chris, should we start by talking about what has bizarrely turned into one of the bigger scandals of the election campaign, which, of course, is Gamblegate. Last time I was still paying attention, there were at least five Tory politicians, a bit more than half a dozen police officers, and even one Labour candidate.
Token Labour candidate. Yeah.
Who gave them an out, but who have all been embroiled in this question about were they betting on the election date, whether or not they were going to win their own particular race. As a consequence of this, we've had two Tory candidates and one Labour candidate essentially being disowned by their respective parties. The Gambling Commission are involved. The police are investigating at least their own officers. It's really become a big story, another Partygate-style circus. Mm. But you wrote a piece for us in last week about how really everyone got excited over not very much. Do you want to tell us a bit more about what you said in that piece?
Yeah, well, I think they're getting excited about the wrong thing more than anything. So it is kind of interesting, actually, what is legal, what's considered against the rules, which is different to being illegal in this kind of betting. So anything like this, where you've got a small number of people do genuinely know the outcome in terms of the election date, which is that was the first scandal that kicked this off. It's a bit like there are people who know who's going to win the Academy Award for such and such, or who's going to be in the Big Brother house. They probably shouldn't be betting on the outcome. Whether it's illegal or not is a bit of a grey area, because it very rarely comes up. The Gambling Commission very rarely investigates individuals for betting. There will be times when the bookmaker themselves might come in and void the bet, saying you had what the Gambling Commission calls restricted information. Mm-hmm. That's pretty dodgy. But you're still not affecting the result. If you're in a position to affect the results, like if you're pulling up a horse that you're jockeying, that would be flat out illegal. What the Met police officers have allegedly done is flat out illegal because it's misconduct in a public office. What people like Philip Davis have done, which is back themselves to lose to the tune of $8,000 in Philip's case, is almost certainly not illegal. And apparently is quite common practice. We didn't know this, do we? I don't think in individual voters, but apparently they do it partly as a sort of superstitious thing, partly just simply to give them a bit of compensation if they lose a seat, but they're not trying to lose their seat. Right. So they could affect the outcome, but it's very unlikely they're going to. Right. So it's all quite a gray area. What's actually against the rules and what isn't. But what interests me is how this information is getting out there. Mm-hmm. So the Gambling Commission, generally speaking, never discuss investigations that are ongoing. They never say, we've started an investigation into such and such. It's nearly always a company when they do investigate. Like I say, they don't tend to investigate individuals. And they never discuss an ongoing investigation. Now, somebody with a lot of information, ironically restricted information, has been leaking to numerous different media outlets. Newsnight got one, Sunday Times got one, Guardians are the least one. And every story you read about this begins by saying the Guardian or the BBC or whatever understands that such and such has been investigated by the Gambling Commission for political betting. That journalist then calls up the political figure. They then go, yeah, I am being investigated by the Gambling Commission. How do you know that? They then get suspended or resign, and the same pattern happens over and over again. Now, given that this is having a, you could argue, a tangible effect on the election, perhaps not the overall result, but certainly the it stopped the Conservatives getting out whatever useless lines they've been trying to get out, you know, and stopped them, you know, doing the election campaign as planned, if they had a plan. It seems to me to be election interference, basically. And it might not be somebody in the Gambling Commission, but you've got to say the obvious suspects. I think the Gambling Commission, or somebody at least, accused the Met Police of leaking this information. The Met immediately denied this quite strongly. I don't think it would be the Met, partly because they're very used to keeping suspects' names quiet. It's second nature to them not to disclose, you know, who they've nabbed. But also, they simply wouldn't know about some of these cases. Like the first one, Craig, somebody or other, he wasn't under police investigation, so there's no reason they would have known. The only people who would have known would be the bookmaker, and it's not likely to be them, or somebody in the Gambling Commission. So I obviously can't prove this, but there has to be a strong suspicion that somebody in the Gambling Commission who has restricted information is trying to affect the result of an event, which is kind of ironic, given that is what some of these politicians have been accused of.
And Gambling Commission, if you're listening, please reach out, push back. But it's a classic example of people seem to get upset about the wrong things, not least because the Labour candidate you referenced, I think it's Kevin Craig was his name, in Suffolk somewhere, who has, again, kind of bet against himself because it's like a 25,000 Tory majority. And even given the current route of the Tories that they seem to be facing, it seems unlikely he'll get that. I mean, the other thing that came out in that story was that he'd given the Labour Party about £200,000 over the course of the last decade.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're basically just buying a candidacy is...
That's quite interesting, isn't it?
Probably a bit more icky than betting against himself in a no-hoper race. But
you would think so, yeah. But I think, maybe he's the only Labour MP to have done this, but it seems unlikely. I think that whoever's responsible for this leak decided we'd better throw some Labour guy under the bus just to make it look like it's not a one-sided political smear campaign or whatever.
And call me a bit of a cynic, Tim, but this is the sort of thing you kind of assumed might be going on. Do you reckon there's a bit of feigned outrage from some of the media about this?
Yeah, there's been a lot of feigned outrage throughout the election. You know, any time there's a hint of something that's approaching a story, you know, it's, you know, the press are all over it. I think that's what's been particularly shocking about the Gamblegate furore. It's over so little, and it's rumbled on now for like best part of a week, over a week now.
No, 3 weeks.
Three
since it started, yeah.
3 weeks.
After the electoral campaign.
And over relatively little money as well.
Except in the case of Philip, who went for it. I don't even know how he managed to get that much on. I would have thought there'd be a restriction on how much you can certainly back yourself to lose. But he found a bookie somewhere, so that maybe they've got more faith in him winning the seat than he has. Mm-hmm.
It is a spectacularly low rent scandal, you know, compared to, I've seen people desperately trying to liken it to the, you know, the dark days of the major administration and the
it does seem kind of grubby, doesn't it? The thing about betting when the election is going to be does seem a bit grubby at the very least.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't want to endorse what's going on. I think that like, you know, without starting to sound like one of those who is feigning outrage, you know, the lack of seriousness with which these people have treated public office, treated the chance to represent a constituency is just, you know, kind of breathtaking. You know, that they don't seem to have taken any of this very seriously. The general election, they just seem to have seen as a bit of a side issue to the other games, fun and games they want to get up to. Mm-hmm. It does devalue That's the value political.
There's also a kind of ineptitude to it, I think, as well, because two of the people who've been implicated by the Gambling Commission investigation was one of the campaign directors in Tory HQ and also one of their kind of chief data managers. So these are people who are not just politicians, they're not just candidates. These are people in charge of the campaign, in charge of the grid, who might not think, you know, if this gets out, this could look quite bad for us. And we're already 20 points behind. And also, as we've been talking about, the fact that they were risking this on the basis of not a hell of a lot of money, even when they knew exactly when the election was going to be.
I think that it probably is because there was some sort of limit on how much you could put on. The thing with political betting, it's, like I said before, it's one of those relatively few things you can bet on where the bookies do know that some people mm-hmm. know the outcome, or very, very, they know more than the bookies do anyway, which is not always the case. And so they will tend, there won't be a lot of liquidity in the markets on things like Betfair anyway, because not that many people bet on it. So you might not be able to put more than 100 quid on even if you wanted to. But also I think they would tend to start asking questions if someone's putting a lot of dosh on. But he said, I'm very, very interested to know how it came about in the first place. Mm-hmm. Did the bookies volunteer this information to the Gambling Commission? Did the Gambling Commission demand that they hand over a list of everyone who's in politics, who bet on politics? What's going on there? And the thing is, after the election, no one will ever mention this again.
No.
Some of those police officers might possibly get disciplined or pulled up in court. I bet you the rest of it gets dropped because most of these people haven't done anything wrong, really. And I think the whole thing is just a pantomime to mm-hmm. get us through the election campaign.
It does feel like
forgotten, and there won't be a leak inquiry either, which there should be.
No. I mean, also, it does feel like we've got, or a certain section of the kind of anti-Tory press have got hooked on very low rent scandal, especially since Partygate. And then there was this kind of diminishing return since then. So there was Partygate. They tried to get Rishi Sunak not wearing a seatbelt going for a while. I mean, he even actually got fined as a consequence of that. And that was kind of any example of supposedly tawdry Tory behaviour. But like you were saying, Tim, at least Tory scandals used to involve, you know, extramarital affairs.
Also erotic asphyxiation.
Exactly. The odd Chelsea kit shall remain nameless. But it does feel like this is the most we have.
Rent boys. Where are the rent boys in this election campaign?
Well, that's one of the funny things. And people speculate that this is a concept.
That's a Lib Dem, to be fair, wasn't it?
Well, not just Lib Dems.
No, exactly. There was a bit of this before, like a lot of Tories having to step down because they found themselves with bad people in the middle of the night and so on.
Yeah.
But that's one.
PFAS.
As a consequence of PFAS, the greatest washing machine salesman the Midlands has ever seen. But apparently, a lot of the affairs stuff, that's just kept a lid on now in the kind of post Leveson climate because they're very, very nervous about reporting that stuff. Yeah. The Matt Hancock thing only really made it over the line of public interest for a lot of people because of the fact it was the COVID rules.
Breaking rule.
But there have been, even during lockdown, there have been a lot of
kind
of open secret affairs and things.
You have
things
to go on
Potlitch
or something to find out about what's really going
on. More or less, that's where, if you want to get the truth, I would advise most people going to. But while we're still talking about politics and the election, Tim, you wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago now talking about what a Keir Starmer government is going to look like. That's been a bit of an open question because the man seems to change his position on all kinds of things. Has been pursuing famously this sort of Ming Vars strategy of not wanting to commit to too much beyond a handful of pretty pedestrian pledges. But one thing you looked at in particular was the influence of the blob, of the civil service, of the quangocracy, and how much that shaped both his thinking, but also how Starmer seems to want to go into government. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what you were talking about there, what you found out?
I think, as you say, the question that people keep asking themselves is what exactly a Starmer government will stand for. And in some ways, it's almost like the wrong question because Starmer's not particularly interested in standing for anything. I think he's not interested in the ends of politics or any pursuing grand political ambitions or, grand policies. He's more interested in kind of process. He's interested in the means of politics. You know, he's always talking endlessly about, I just want to get things done. I think he's asked by his biographer, Tom Baldwin. Hagiographer, Tom Baldwin, who says, tell me, what is the essence of Starmerism? And Starmer splutters and says, it is, I just want to get things done. Like that.
Do you buy into the Peter Hitchens view that he's going to introduce Stalinism?
No, exactly.
Pavloism.
That's the thing. There's nothing surreptitious about Starmer. It's all visible.
He's going to execute everyone who wears glasses. Send us out all into the countryside.
I don't think he's got the vim and vigor, I think, for that kind of.
And also, even when you read about his days writing for that obscure Trotskyist journal, Pavloist journal, he was famously, or at least the quotes are, that he was just involved in the kind of organisational side of things much more than he was actually writing, which seems to reflect who he is.
Sounds about right. It was a ring of truth to him.
He was principally a logistics man. I think that was the
theoretician of the.
I don't. you know, you listen to people who were around him at the time, and they say he wasn't really interested in the actual theory of the politics. He was really interested in getting the magazine out there and printing. He was interested in printing processes.
Things done, yeah.
And yeah, exactly, yeah. And, you know,
someone has to do these
economies of scale and stuff. Starmer himself is a kind of technocrat, but people focus on him being a human rights lawyer, but that almost misses the point. I think one of the most interesting things about Starmer is he was director of public prosecutions. He's actually immersed in the managerial state as much as anything else, more than anything else. I think that kind of shaped his outlook. It also kind of fitted his outlook as a kind of technocrat, as someone who's interested in procedure and a bureaucrat. And not only is there Starmer leading this kind of this party that promises the kind of technocratic restoration, those around him as well are equally kind of creatures of the kind of managerial state, creatures of the blob. Mm-hmm. Rachel Reeves, of course, you know, she honed her skills at the Bank of England, which at that point, of course, in like 2000, just been granted control of a monetary policy by Gordon Brown. So she herself is very much a product of that kind of managerial state.
And you talk about Sue Gray as well.
Well, I think that's
will remember.
The keenness with which Starmer pursues Sue Gray.
Who is now his chief of staff, was previously a top civil servant, was kind of Boris Johnson's
investigator
over Partygate.
Neutral voice.
Yeah, nothing untoward about
it's
that.
Unbelievable, really.
But tell us about the Sue Gray part of this, because there has been a lot of kind of write-ups of how central she has been to this plan for government. And it seems like it's as much about getting the Labour Party to understand why they have to get closer to the civil service rather than vice versa, almost.
Yeah, but I think she herself has said this, again, to Starmer's friend and hagiographer, Tom Baldwin. I think she said it's all about making sure the shadow cabinet understand what it will be like to work with the civil service. So as soon as they assume power, they'll be able to get things up and running, you know, with no problems, no friction. But actually what it starts to sound like is that we will have a government which is automatically sort of deferential to the needs and interests and worldview of the civil service. Actually, probably shares those needs and interests of the civil service. And I think one of the most telling lines of this whole campaign, which I think is almost Sue Gray's line, is that over and over again, after every kind of policy has been dropped, after or a refusal to make a kind of policy promise, Keir Starmer will say, "We're not going to make any promises we can't keep." And that's the big thing. Incredible for an election campaign to have almost as like your manifesto sort of headline. We are not going to do anything that we won't be able to do. We're not going to make any grand promises to you. So it's almost, he's actively campaigning on not having anything much to offer the electorate because there's a chance it wouldn't come true. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be able to realise that. And that is what Sue Gray has been telling the shadow cabinet, that you shouldn't offer anything that we won't be able to deliver. So right away, the low ambitions of the Labour Party are almost being informed by the low ambitions of the state, of the blob, if you like. Mm-hmm. And it's just all perfectly aligned. There'll be very few people enthusiastic about the Labour Party, and certainly very few people are enthusiastic about the next Labour government. But I think they are really excited in Whitehall about the new Labour government, because it's almost like they recognise themselves, the mm-hmm. civil service, Whitehall recognises itself in this incoming government. And it's really going to do the bidding, I think, of Whitehall rather than...
What does that mean, you think, in terms of policy?
I think it means very limited policy. I think that's
that's all right, I can get behind that.
Well, what I mean is, like, in terms of, Rachel Reeves has already made a big thing about, ensuring that... we're going to be fiscally responsible. We're going to ensure there's very limited spending and so on. That there's just
sense again, can you get behind that.
But I guess the point is that just the limits of the kind of policy making ambition are almost just are basically an expression of the limits of what the civil service thinks is what they're capable of. And I think they'll end up just adjusting to the expectations and worldview of the blob.
It's also quite dispiriting, I think, because one thing that's become clear over the course of the past few years is not just that the blob, the state, the civil service was increasingly defining itself against the elected government. I mean, on all kinds of issues, you would see leaks and even people coming out and openly saying that they saw their role was to basically take the edges off this supposedly dangerous populist government. Mm. But also just how inept the state has been, how sclerotic, how incapable of doing things. This is obviously one of the things that Dominic Cummings has been banging on for a very long time, which is just because of the structure of it, the perverse incentives, all this kind of thing. You just have bluffers and duffers in the civil service who can administer public services absolutely terribly, but just remain in place, moved on to other plum jobs. And it seems like if you've got a government that claims to be so devoted to delivery as this incoming Labour government is, surely part of that equation would be trying to work out how to get the civil servants to actually do their jobs in person.
Well, if they want to deliver things that civil service is in favour of, that shouldn't be too difficult. I think that's the issue, isn't it? That the civil service does want to do Labour-ish type things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can see the way in which Labour's alignment with the civil service and the interests and worldview of the civil service will affect such things as our relationship with the EU. I think you can see how, you know, there won't be any explicit, overturning of Brexit, but you will certainly see a kind of just a move towards the EU, just a willingness to open ourselves up to membership or integration into existing EU structures, just because that's what the civil service thinks is the right thing to do. And as Chris says, I think, you know, Labour share that worldview.
We've read the policy papers and it seems like the right thing to do. And also I do worry, this is less a civil service point, more Labour in general, is that the cultural/constitutional stuff, some of which is in the manifesto, some of which isn't, is probably going to fill the void where any more adventurous economic or other policies would sit. The Race Equality Act is something we talked about a fair bit. There's also kind of hanging in the background like Gordon Brown's plans for the House of Lords and the Constitution, which could be potentially pretty drastic. And it's worth remembering things like Bank of England independence. I mean, it wasn't in the New Labour 1997 manifesto. I think it was vague what it is they were going to do before they actually went for it. So maybe that's the sort of thing that we've got to look forward to. But you don't seem that concerned about the Starmerist deep state, Chris, are you?
Well, I don't know if what Tim says is true. It wouldn't surprise me if Friday morning you get busted and dragged off to prison. You know, so it could go either way.
So you're worried about your...
He might not do anything. I don't know. How can you tell what Starmer's actually going to do? He obviously... Well, either he lied to the membership in 2020, he's lying to the public now. But one way or the other, he's quite a convincing liar. Isn't he?
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. You can't say he's never lied. He's clearly... Either he was his right-winger, he pretended to be left-wing to become leader, or he's the opposite. And really, there's no way of telling, because he seemed equally convincing in 2020 as he does now. I don't know what he's going to do.
He is the most slippery politician.
And he doesn't really get called out on it. I honestly thought during the election campaign, firstly, I thought the Tories would fight a lot better election campaign than they have. I thought they might have some dirt on somebody or some brilliant policies. But no, it's just Sunak going like, no, we're going to put your taxes, we'll put your children into the army. Unbelievably inept campaign. I don't think it's suddenly going to get any better. We're recording this on Tuesday, by the way, folks. Secondly, I thought at some point Andrew Neil would be grilling all the leaders, and Andrew Neil against Starmer for an hour, I thought would be pretty good, because he would make the kind of points I've just made there. It's like, who are you? When were you lying then, or are you lying now? But no one's really asking these questions. Even the interviews have been pathetic.
I mean, even Beth Rigby actually got in some, which is telling in terms of Starmer's ability to deal with scrutiny and an interview, but just saying, well, how can anyone trust you if you said one thing to the membership and now another thing to the country?
What was his answer? That he thought Corbyn was going to win and lose, isn't it?
That's the thing. He got forced into this ridiculous argument of, I campaigned for Corbyn because I thought he was going to lose, which came
people... Well, a lot of people voted for him in 2017 because they thought he was going to lose.
I think Starmer does try to answer the question why he keeps changing his mind. He basically says because times change, doesn't he?
Well, it hasn't. What, in the space of 2 years? Yeah, 2020, 2022, completely different politics.
I sound like a Starmer spokesman, but I think he'd say, I'm adjusting to the new economic realities or the new financial realities. And that would go hand in hand with that just kind of adjustment to what, you know, the Office for of Budget Responsibility.
Right, so if the economy got a bit better, he'd suddenly be in favour of nationalising everything and he'd be Jeremy Corbyn's best friend again.
He genuinely believes in nothing. Like, I think he has vague instincts and inclinations, which are sort of soft left-ish.
Yeah,
but
you're probably right.
It's quite clearly more enamoured with power and with a kind of sense of climbing the ladder and career progression and so on, that kind of overwhelms everything else. I mean, the part of the reason apparently that he surrounded himself with Blairites rather than Brownites, as people say, is because, well, they've got more experience of winning and they've got more nous and so on. That's why it's purely all to the ends of winning office. And I do think that there's not going to be some great reveal, great surprise. I think what he'll try to do is find things like dusting off Gordon Brown's plans for the union. Votes for 16-year-olds and call that a legacy.
Yeah.
And he'll also get to ban smoking, because Sunak, in all of his ineptitude, tried to make that his legacy and then didn't manage to get it through before the election he himself called scuppered it. So
I think
he's a political genius, that man.
He is. We're fast running out of time, but we should move on and talk a bit about... ultra-processed foods. I know we don't talk about it that much on this podcast, but bear with us. But there's been...
letter of complaint.
There has been a letter of complaint. First of all, Christian, we talk about the latest news line on UPS, and then we also want to get into this fascinating email that we received from an alleged nutritionist upbraiding us for some of our previous comments on this topic. But Chris, essentially the kind of godfather of ultra-processed foods.
Mm. This Carlos Montero, I think he's called.
Indeed.
Carlo Montero.
Who came up with the NOVA classification?
Yeah, NOVA, food. Not an acronym.
He has come out and made some comments at a conference, I believe, talking about how the usual stuff about ultra-processed food. He compares it to tobacco in the UPF industry, to the tobacco industry.
Yeah.
With once warnings and so on. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what he said? And what you think?
This is the guy who invented the very phrase ultra-processed food in about 2010. He's Brazilian. I don't know what he actually technically is qualified in, scientist of some sort. And he just came up with this fairly, initially quite vague definition. And it's just still pretty vague now, isn't it? Let's be honest. Just anything that contains various things that you wouldn't have in your kitchen is a pretty... pretty accurate definition of it.
Anything that poorer people
eat. Anything that made by corporations, basically. Anything in a package or a box or plastic that's made by a corporation is going to kill you and give you cancer and give you low cognitive ability and all this rubbish. We talked about it many times on the podcast. He's a firebrand, to put it most politely. I mean, it's only a couple of years ago he was saying that all processed food should be basically banned. Now he's saying it should have tobacco style warnings on it, which I suppose implies a moderation in his view. I mean, it's just so tediously predictable, isn't it? Everything people don't like, they just go, let's treat it like tobacco, let's put warnings on it, and then when that doesn't work, let's put a tax on it, and when that doesn't work, let's put it in plain packaging, blah, blah, blah. And the media lap it up every time. And like you say, he was only talking at some conference. He's done very well at this whole ultra-processed food thing. It's amazing people take it seriously. What can you say? It's just... Is the government ever going to do it? What would you even put on the warning? What are you going to actually say? Ultra-processed food kills you? Ultra-processed food causes cancer? Because you're going to end up with some serious litigation. Because it's, you know, as I've often said before, this might seem like kind of, you know, poking at the weak spot in the theory that's to say that ultra-processed food includes whole grain sliced bread. But it is whole grain sliced bread that Chris Van Tulleken put on the cover of his book.
Yep.
You know, he clearly thinks it's dangerous stuff. So we're going to start putting on brown bread causes cancer. Okay, well, you're going to get sued. Someone is going to take you to court from the brown bread industry if you do that, because it's not true and you haven't got any evidence it's true.
Someone from Big Brown Bread will come after you. One thing that was interesting reading this, even the Guardian write-up of this, was that there was still some pushback. Towards the end, there was another kind of public health academic who was saying, hold on now.
Yeah.
Of course we should ban smoking because it's obviously terrible. But you cannot compare UPFs to that. And it reminds me of something we talked about a few weeks ago, where in the latest edition of Chris Van Tulleken's book, he devotes a lot of time to having a go at these public health people who are on one panel who were saying maybe treating UPF as the new tobacco is probably not a good idea because for all these different reasons. Is it actually more of a live debate amongst the public health blob as to whether some of these more zealous people are going a little bit too far? Is that a bit more of a live issue than some of the other things?
I don't know about the public health blob, but amongst food scientists, it's a very live issue. Very few of them are prepared to put their head above the parapet, because what happens is, as happened with that little seminar, whatever it was, where you had a few naysayers politely suggesting maybe we're rushing to judgment, is that Van Tulleken said, oh, well, this person's had grant funding from Warburton's. So bound to be defending brown
bread. Malign influence of the war.
And the reality is that if you're a food scientist and you've never had a grant from the food industry, you're probably not a very good food scientist. That's where food scientists obviously should be working. They can't all be working for government. We don't want them to be working for government. And in effect, only the worst ones probably do work for government. So I wouldn't trust a food scientist who's never worked with the food industry. That's the whole point of their job, as far as I'm concerned. But in these, you know, retarded times, that is considered to be a respectable argument that diminishes anyone's contribution, no matter how better qualified they are than Chris Van Tulleken. Mm-hmm.
And Tim, I understand you're probably new to the whole UPF thing. We talk about it all the time, but very few people do. What do you make of this attempt to make it the new tobacco, the new sort of evil where health is concerned?
It is interesting the way in which it has kind of taken off a little bit.
That book was huge. The Chris Van Tulleken
exactly. Yeah,
it's still in top 10.
And you know, it's now it's sort of almost becoming a truism, unfortunately, that there is something terribly wicked about so-called ultra-processed food, and by which people tend to think, you know, it's almost like another semi-euphemism for fast food or for, you know, microwavable curries or something like that. There is just this acceptance now amongst, I think, you know, the right-thinking commentariat that there is something evil out there lurking in our supermarkets, which is, you know, causing terrible damage to society. So I'm struck by the way in which, despite the lack of evidence for it, despite the fact that it's a nonsense category, the fact that it is just taken off, because it does appeal to something about in the kind of contemporary.
It appeals to a few things. It appeals to the kind of clean living, you know, idea, urge, whatever you want to call it. It appeals to anti-capitalism because it's about food made by corporations rather than artisan bakeries and this kind of thing, food markets. It's very heavily class-based. It appeals to, you know, there's a lot of people who've got borderline eating disorders these days, and it really appeals to them. But it's stupid. Yeah, and the commentary are just not that bright, and they're all sheep, and they just go in the same direction. I mean, all the people going about ultra-processed food are the same people who were going about sugar 10 years ago. Sugar's kind of been forgotten about because they found something else, and probably in 5 years' time, they'll have found something else. Maybe they'll go back to fat or something. I don't know. I'm bored. Do I sound like I'm bored of it? I am bored of these idiots talking about ultra-processed.
You did suggest this story this week.
I know, I'm not bored of it talking about this story, but it does just depress me.
Well, to fire you up, shall we
let's
reach into the postbag?
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
So this is a very special postbag because it's a very long email of complaint from a gentleman who, I dare say, is probably the first bit of spiked, well, Snowden content he's come across, who's emailed in to basically upbraid us for a recent episode of this podcast. It was
titled, before last, I think.
Exactly, the snobbery of the ultra-processed food panic. Should we just go through this, Chris?
Yeah,
maybe
you
can answer our critic here.
I'll fisk it.
I feel like I should do it in a disparaging voice or something.
Yeah,
you know,
doing
like,
a stupid voice. Like, Monty Python. Okay.
Dear team.
It's actually quite long, so I'll probably go mad if I try and do that. Dear team, bit familiar if you ask me, but he recently listened to the podcast. I want to email you to let you know what a all block caps, absolute load of tosh the entire episode was. So this guy, his name is Blank. He's a registered nutritionist and content lead at Blank.
At a company that we've already Googled.
Exactly.
Which sells some sort of dietary plan for £229 a month.
All for the public good.
Yeah.
So he wanted to send us some information on why ultra-processed foods are not benign. Specifically, he wants to let us know that this idea of eat less and exercise more merely displays your complete ignorance of the complexity of obesity as a disease process.
Not if you're familiar with the laws of thermodynamics, but yeah, carry on.
That's that one dealt with. So number one, Chris, UPFs are designed to make us eat more.
Are they?
So this particular claim, he says that observational studies show that individuals who consume the highest amount of UPFs are 79% more likely to be obese than individuals with the lowest intake.
Yeah, because they eat more food. People eat more food, more likely to be obese. If you eat more food, you're more likely to eat more UPF.
All right, one down. UPFs, I don't impact our brain and gut health.
Yeah,
gut health is... I can imagine them making that point. But have you ever heard this idea that we're kind of destroying our grey matter as well? By
I looked at the study he cited there. It says it's an association. I'd very much be very surprised if there's any causal link. And I don't think there's even a biological mechanism for that to happen. A lot of things are associated with cognitive, you know, low IQ or whatever, but it doesn't mean that it's caused by the thing that's associated with.
Finally, and this is a question that I suppose we could all get into, the arrogance of this podcast.
Oh, well, we're an arrogant podcast, so what?
This is his most important point. It's the one that he's building to. You're discussing a topic that you clearly understand absolutely nothing about. What do you say to that?
Well, he's a nutritionist, which isn't even a proper job.
And we looked up his... How much do this gentleman's services cost?
£229, most of which just seems to be a dose of semaglutide.
That's hilarious. So what... Maybe that's how we came across, because weren't we talking about
I'm in favor
Johan
of
Hari's
glutide. I'm not in favour of Johan Hari, but...
So it's obviously not a grifter.
No, you're not a grifter.
Stretch of the imagination.
Carry on. What else have you got to say about the arrogance of us?
Ironically, you criticised Dr. Tulikin because you noted the five experts on this panel had connections to the food industry. This isn't a benign connection. They will defend their industry to the hilt despite the ramifications on human health.
Right. Well, will they, though? Right. Experts. So just who are these people on this panel? They're extremely qualified people, including the guy who runs or used to run the Scientific Commission on Nutrition, which is not a pro-food industry organization, that slashed the sugar guidelines for no reason a few years ago. And he, in fact, like most of the people on that panel, a massive nanny statist. It goes back to what I was saying before, that, you know, people like Van Tulik and others smear people just because they've ever had any association with industry, whereas I would smear people for not having an association with industry. I'd also smear people for being nutritionists, which is not a proper job. It's just a certificate you can get from nearly anywhere. So more, there's some more abuse at the end. At the very least, be humble and acknowledge to your listeners, by the way, we're not nutritionists here, so we can't pretend to be experts on the matter. Look, mate, I've looked at your website. I think you're a grifter. You're making no sense in this. Talk about Dunning-Kruger at the end. I reject your complaint, sir. If you want to come on the podcast and discuss it, you know where to find us. Have we had any response from the people at the lady about the
wheelie
suitcases?
But I dare say we haven't reached out.
We should reach out more than just, I suppose, mentioning on the podcast so they don't listen to us.
I know, exactly. But it's the crossover podcast episode that everyone's been waiting for. It's the lady in Last Orders.
Yeah.
Sounds like a weird film. We're almost out of time. But Tim, as you may know, we ask all of our guests, just as a final question, if you had to have one ban, what would it be? But given the fact that this is quite a libertarian anti-ban podcast, the only condition really is that it's got to be something quite petty, something that irks you. Chris's... Like
nutritionists.
Nutritionist is Chris's latest one. Just something, someone, some phenomenon that irritates you. What would you like to ban?
Oh, it's difficult when you're finally given a chance to vent your prejudices. There's so much that wants to come out, isn't there? So let's just limit it.
Yourself, please. But, you know, within the realms of decency.
I think it's been a long standing grievance of mine. It's sniffing. It's people sniffing in public. People sniffing in my earshot.
It's like they've got a cold.
It's like they've got a cold, but they haven't got any means with which to deal with the excess phlegm. Like,
so they just do the sniff.
Yeah, they don't have a handkerchief. So,
people not having handkerchiefs on them.
I would like to ban the sniffing. And they were way.
But you're open-minded about the solution. It could be a tissue.
I know. I'm thinking something, because if it's a chance to be quite petty, I think some kind of mandatory handkerchief. Like,
right. You're happy with people blowing their noses around you?
Oh, absolutely. Because that's a way to deal with it. The repeated sniffing. And then if it's not the sniffing, there's the other sound, which is the sound of someone. It's like a sinus scraping noise as they send the phlegm back down their throat.
They're struggling, to be fair, aren't they?
They can be struggling.
They don't want to be out. They've got a cold. They're trying their best.
I see where you're going with this. You're suggesting this could lead to a work from home.
I'm kind filled of. With empathy for the human race.
And that's what you're known for. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here.
So I always see it from the victim's point of view. But yeah, they should have a hanky on them. You're right.
But
tissue paper on the toilet.
It doesn't have to be a handkerchief, to be clear. Right, you're saying tissues are fine.
Tissues are fine. I'd rather it was an old-fashioned cotton handkerchief, which they could store up the sleeve, like in the good old days before this became a blight on certainly my life, and I suspect many other people.
Double up as a hat at the seaside.
It is multi-purpose.
Ever since you started hanging around with cocaine addicts, real nuisance. Well, you are on Canary Wharf, you know.
That's true, yeah. There's something...
If you're around. All the yuppies. Still talk about yuppies? Is that I think still a thing?
It's been replaced by other kind of neologisms. What have we had? There was something. What was after yuppies?
I don't know.
You're talking, yuppies are the era of the Filofax.
I'm picturing someone with one of those giant car phones.
Well, what's the modern equivalent? Do people even talk about it anymore? There's hipsters, but that's a different thing completely.
Yeah. Terrible lack of looking man.
If you know what the modern equivalent of the word yuppie is, please email us at lastorders@spy-online.com.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.